Carl Hancock Rux could easily be considered a contemporary Renaissance man. He's recorded CDs, written plays, poems, and books. He's performed one-man shows and collaborated with countless other artists. And the guy is still in his 30s. But when critics speak of him, they're more likely to use the word powerful than prolific. His work contains staggering images of both urban blight and urban bliss, and has made Rux the toast of the New York City underground. Carl Hancock Rux is in our New York studio. Hi, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you're not going to be writing an opera during this interview, are you? Or
I would love to, but I don't think I could do it during the interview, but I might do it on the train as I'm headed back to Brooklyn.
How many projects are you working on at any one time?
You know, last year, or about 2 years ago, I was working on the play Talk, and that was about 3 years of workshop and production, and I was also working on my final draft of the novel Asphalt, and I was recording the album Apothecary RX in the studio. So that, I would say that was the height of it, about three major projects at the same time.
Let's talk about the two things that are just out. We have the novel Asphalt and the new CD, Apothecary RX. Let's start with the record. You know, this thing could fit into about eight or nine different bins at the record store. You know, the rap, the jazz, spoken word, soul, rock. How would you describe it to someone who might be thinking about buying it?
I think it's just essentially good music. I said to somebody else that I think it's, someone had interviewed me from Spain about that record, and they said, you know, what do you think about the fact that you're using Tibetan monks chanting, and you're using sitar, and you're using rock, and they said, you know, using and all these forms that are not essentially black music. And I was like, well, I don't know that I think that's true. I mean, I think that this is, in its own way, just black music or soul music. I wanted to make a soul album, but my definition of soul isn't necessarily R&B Radio's definition of soul. I mean, I wasn't trying to make a neo-soul record. I wasn't even thinking about genre or form. I was just thinking about what occurred to me and how the music sounded and what inspired me to make the music. So I think I would just tell people it's a soulful record.
11 more days in the city.
What does the title mean, Apothecary RX?
Well, I was hanging around a lot in London for a period, and I loved going into the apothecaries, those pharmacies, those places with, you know, drugs and remedies. And of course, I would imagine what it must have been like in the early days, maybe the days of Shakespeare, you know, and what the apothecaries looked like and the old jars. So when I made this record, I wanted to make a record that was complete with all of my healing remedies and, you know, all of my poisons, so that we could sort of begin on a level of vulnerability and say that this part of us is not healed, this part of us is. You know, let's talk about it, let's sing about it.
What would you consider your poisons?
Well, wow, so many. I mean, I was born in Harlem, but grew up in New York City foster care because my mother was paranoid, schizophrenic, institutionalized all of my life. My grandmother was an alcoholic who died when I was four. I wasn't adopted until I was 15 years old. Lovely couple who also had problems with alcoholism and spousal abuse. So some of my poisons have been about recovering from all of that and not to be so completely tainted or ashamed of my history and my past. I think that history in its own way was a poison that I'm trying to turn into a remedy.
The first tune is one that's rather polyrhythmic. It's called I Got a Name. And starts off the disc. Why did you choose this one as an introduction?
Well, I thought it would be a really sort of an assaulting way to introduce oneself. Basically, it says, I have a name, and I'm sort of running through all the different things that, you know, I've been called, or all the different ways that I'm perceived. And not just me. I mean, just young men, young African-American men, people. And I wanted to sort of scream that, you know, beyond all the stereotypes, beyond all the one-dimensional ways we are seen, we have names that we have to give ourselves, not just the names that people have given us.
Nigga, You go nigger, negro, nigritude, black boy, bastard, child, African American, aphrodisiac, young buck, superstud.
Right. Yeah, very painful names. And I feel like I've lived long enough at 34 to have been identified by people as every single one of those things. And sometimes it was a negative, sometimes it was a positive, sometimes I didn't feel like it defined me at all. So, yeah, it was about just throwing out all the different names that I feel like I've been identified with.
You've been prancing, freeform, breakdancing, sexist, racist, rapping. What's that, your negative thought happen? I got a name.
You spent a lot of time refining your work as a member of the New Eurekan Poetry Movement. Explain just briefly what that group is and then how it contributed to your craft, to your work.
It was a phenomenal influence. The New Eurekan Poets Cafe, which really began as a place for New Eurekans, Latinos, Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, Cubans, whoever, to write poetry and to express their political thoughts, and this is, you know, in the mid-70s, continued to exist. And by the time this new group came in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, it was amazing because there was I feel like everybody was sort of really focusing on craft and really focusing on identity, what separated them from the other poet. And we were also meeting the older poets who would come through and who would speak to us and talk about how we achieved delivering a message and making sense of whatever our thesis or idea was, how we entertained the audience or did not entertain the audience. But there was a point in which I felt like I needed to leave because I didn't want to be known specifically as a spoken word artist, because I felt like even when I was reading, I would write poetry and I would write texts, I would write essays, and I would stand up and I wouldn't just read them, I wouldn't just speak them. Sometimes I would sing them. I mean, that's how the whole music thing really started. And I used to do a poem called Red Velvet Dress Lullaby. It really was just written as a poem, but when I opened my mouth to speak it, to perform it for people, I couldn't allow myself to simply speak it.
Can we hear it? Can we hear Red Dress?
Sure. I'll give you some of it. First he was a boy and then he was a man. First he was a boy and then he was a man and mispronounced profanities of little football head boys knocked him down and scarred him for life because he played with little Barbie doll girls, combed his hair, and he played in a gentle world of painlessness. He allowed them to baptize him with faggot and sissy names of ridicule, branding him with words of mockery. And he kept them as his own, hid them secretly between his first and his last name, between his pride and his shame. I'll stop there.
You know, it sounds like chant.
Yeah, exactly. There were, you know, and there were so many different ways to chant that I found. When I was growing up with my adoptive family, they'd both been born and raised in Harlem. He was born in 1913. She was born in 1923. So they were raised in sort of at the height of the jazz era. All they played in the house was this great jazz music, and they really spoke about the way Lester Young would bend the horn, how he would sound, what he meant by that, the way Billie Holiday would lay back, how she would sing and snap sort of offbeat. And, I, you know, as a kid, I don't know that I understood any of this or that I really cared, but somehow it stayed with me so that when I began to write text and then wanted to sort of chant it or speak it or infuse it with some kind of a melody, I think that it was all of that, you know, language and the way that my parents listened to music and what they thought was important about it. It was all of that that I think I brought to poetry and to text and how I wanted to perform it with my voice.
You mean we be the lost promise of destiny's translates jealous. Imagination of the wicked dead, we said. Generation of the hip-hop dread, we bled. Replenish the weary soul. Retell the rhymes all foretold. Cuts and spinets and mountain root for you. Cuts and welcome and persimmon fruit to choose.
Let's talk about the novel. Asphalt. You have this protagonist, Racine. He comes to kind of this almost post-apocalyptic, perhaps post-war, New York City. Do you have your book? Would you mind reading a bit for us?
I'd love
yeah.
to.
On page 3, and there's a paragraph that begins, "The city was falling in the year of its reconstruction."
Sure. The city was falling in the year of its reconstruction. The year of city renewal and city planning, of renaming streets and changing demographics, renovating buildings and erecting irrelevant statues, of sweeping fetid bodies beneath the gratings. Old graves were deconsecrated and cemented over with neon animation. New graves were dug for those who could not survive the metamorphosis of terrified urbanity. New buildings have been propped up, bronze and cast iron plaques tacked onto their edifice, an eternal reminder of the dead in their absence. But the dead were not absent. The dead were everywhere monuments had been erected to mark their demise.
You wrote most of this book before September 11, 2001?
I did. I think I was, I don't know what was happening for me that summer. It's very strange, but I did write this before September 11th. The inspiration for the city, a war-torn city, New York City in Reconstruction after war, really came from Greek mythology, because I was working on a play and I was rereading a lot of old plays, and then I found myself rereading Phaedra, which was in Jean-Paul Racine's adaptation of Euripides' Hippolytus. And there was one scene at the end of it where the son, Hippolytus, after he is kicked out of his father's home, his father is a king, and he's accused of something he didn't do, and he's heading toward Athens, where he hears the people are rioting in the streets because they would prefer that he be king, not his father. So I kind of saw that as, you know, the son leaving the city of his shame, headed toward the city of what could be his integrity. And that really was the inspiration for the book.
The character, Racine, that you've created is a club DJ by trade. It is, now, because of that character, the style of the book, I mean, it's slightly unconventional. It's kind of written in kind of a, I don't want to just lump it into the hip-hop category, but it is, you have to approach the reading of this novel differently, I think, the pacing and the rhythm. Deliberately written in such a style to conform with the character?
Well, definitely when he speaks. I mean, when he speaks about music, and especially since he's pretty much, I mean, he's the narrator throughout. When he's speaking about music or the city, I wanted to bring a sort of hip-hop cadence to his language. But, you know, only because I so admire how novelists have used whatever music there was or art there was at the time that they were writing their books, and they sort of, you know, they use the musicality of that in the language of their novels. I mean, I'm speaking about Ralph Ellison and how he, you know, brought jazz into literature. And if you hadn't listened to jazz ever, then it might be hard for you to understand completely what Ralph Ellison was saying. And Janae, I mean, I think, you know, you read a Janae novel, and I think there's something to understand about, you know, theater of the absurd in France at that time, and poetry and language and Baudelaire, and, you know, to understand exactly what the influences were that he so evidently brought to the work.
You once said, in order to be critiqued well, to be accepted, to be financially successful, an artist has to make work that looks like something like the art that already exists in the marketplace. But what if someone says, I don't want to do that. I want to do something else. That sort of sounds like your approach. I mean, not to do what the marketplace demands.
You know, if the marketplace changes clothes one day and it's a color I like, I have no problem. I've certainly had thoughts, and I've tried to be a little more conventional here and, you know, a little more linear there. But I realize that I am who I am, that I have to be really happy, really satisfied with what I want to say.
Carl Hancock Rocks. His new novel is called Asphalt, and his new CD is called Apothecary RX. He joined us from our studios in New York. Thank you so much for your time.
I had the best time. Thank you so much.
To hear a few cuts from the new CD and an additional reading from the book, visit our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.
Weekend Edition Sunday is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. To learn more about the music we play between stories, check the list of songs and artists at npr.org. Click the Music button at the top of the page. This is NPR.